It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Microsoft is moving into the next phase of its data center project in Mount Pleasant. The $3.3 billion development is on the former Foxconn site in Racine County.
Microsoft has begun developing hundreds of acres of land it owns in the area and continues to acquire additional parcels of private property to expand its footprint.
Officials expect the campus to create thousands of jobs when it opens in 2026.
We're checking in on the latest developments in the project and what local leaders are hoping it could do for the area. Teddy Nykel is a reporter covering real estate and growth, construction, and healthcare for the Milwaukee Business Journal. Teddy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Can you paint us a picture? What does this look like, this development that Microsoft owns now in Mount Pleasant? Is construction underway?
Yeah, construction is well underway on the first phase, which is in the farthest southeast corner of the more than 1,600 acres that they own. So construction, you know, you'll see cranes in the air, construction trucks going in and out, building that first few data center buildings. And then they're already kind of in the process of grading and getting plans started for additional data centers on that land that they own as well.
And there's a lot of overlap here between the Foxconn site. Foxconn is still there in a much smaller footprint than planned. Connect the dots for us from what Foxconn was going to be to now what Microsoft is doing.
Yeah, so Foxconn, you know, back in, I believe it was around 2017, originally came in with big plans for what they plan to do in Mount Pleasant. They acquired a ton of land. The village of Mount Pleasant pieced together, you know, thousands of acres of land for Foxconn. Foxconn ended up really doing a lot less than they originally promised. And so that left a big opportunity for Mount Pleasant to, they had all this land that they had prepared, thinking that Foxconn was going to be there with, you know, thousands of jobs. And when Foxconn, you know, again, didn't come through with all of those original plans, they were able to kind of, local officials were able to go out and really sell this piece of property to attract a company like Microsoft. So they kind of see it as, you know, the silver lining, as you would say, with what didn't come through with Foxconn.
And Teddy, in your reporting, I've seen a phrase pop up, I think from two or three different people, under promise, over deliver. Are people trying to sell this in a different way than the Foxconn project came in?
Yes, that has been Microsoft's phrase for kind of contextualizing their plans here. I think largely in reaction to Foxconn. Foxconn really did the opposite. They overpromised and underdelivered. So, for example, in terms of jobs, Foxconn, Microsoft has said they will eventually have 2,000 jobs and a $3.3 billion investment. There's a lot of indications that it could go far beyond that, but they're really trying to kind of avoid the disappointment that Foxconn left the area with. Foxconn, on the flip side, they originally said they would invest $10 million, create 13,000 jobs. And in actuality, they ended up investing around $1 billion, and they currently employ around 1,000. So a small fraction of what they first said.
This Microsoft development, what are they actually going to do there? What is what's going to happen on this site?
Yeah, so it's going to be data center buildings that are largely powering AI and the cloud. So Microsoft does a lot of work with cloud-based products and artificial intelligence, as many big companies now are kind of racing to deliver the latest AI products. And so that type of technology requires a ton of computing power. And so these data centers in Mount Pleasant are going to kind of be fueling that technology, again, with the cloud and the AI. And the cool thing is Microsoft is doing a lot to kind of help expand AI expertise in the Milwaukee area alongside this. So they have a really cool center that's going to be at UWM here in Milwaukee that is focused on teaching local businesses how they can leverage AI. So there's going to be about 5 Microsoft employees stationed at UWM to kind of, again, help companies locally prototype AI solutions.
I talked to the UW Milwaukee director of that side of the project as well earlier on Central or here on Wisconsin Today. People can check that out at WPR.org. Teddy, what do we know about the kinds of jobs that Microsoft says they're going to create here?
Sure. So, data centers really aren't known for being huge drivers of jobs, but because they're building so many data center buildings, across this campus, there still will, be around 2,000 data center jobs over time. And this is anywhere from campus management, managing all these buildings, engineering, a few engineers, although these will be largely automated buildings, so that won't be a huge number of the jobs. Security is going to be a big thing, physical security, because these are highly secure buildings, or very high tech technology that they want to make sure is secure. Let's see what else. Construction jobs as well, obviously temporary, but there's going to be 2,300 construction jobs by next year that are going to be building these massive data center campus buildings. IT jobs, management, so kind of a wide range of different types of jobs associated with these data centers.
Teddy Nykal is with us from the Milwaukee Business Journal talking about Microsoft developing a big data center in Racine County, where Foxconn was going to move in with a big project. They have a smaller project there. Teddy, part of the reason Foxconn picked that area originally was water access. They had very thirsty plans, water-intensive plans for some of their technology. I understand these data centers use a lot of water. There's been a sticking point with where this water is going to come from, long-term negotiations with the city of Racine. Can you talk about what's going on in that water supply disagreement?
Yeah, this is a really fascinating aspect to this whole story. So, the city of Racine supplies water to the village of Mount Pleasant. They have for about 20 years. And they expanded those agreements in 2017 when the Foxconn development was first happening. And within the last year or so, Racine, really led by Racine's mayor, has said, we want to renegotiate our water contracts with Mount Pleasant because they're not. According to Racine, they're not the Racine residents aren't benefiting as much as they would like to from these new developments with Microsoft. With Foxconn, when it was 13,000 jobs promised, Racine expected to kind of really benefit from that in terms of getting some of those jobs for Racine's residents. Now that Microsoft is only committed to 2,000 jobs, Racine is saying, that's far different than what we expected with Microsoft, and it's time to renegotiate. So, Racine has actually withheld approving water connections to Mount Pleasant in an effort to kind of get some leverage and bring Mount Pleasant officials to the table to renegotiate. Now, there was a kind of a breakthrough after about a year of not approving new water connections. Racine recently did approve a water connection to the first phase of the Microsoft development, so that is able to move forward. But Racine has said it still plans to push for negotiations with Mount Pleasant to kind of again get a bigger piece of the pie, so to speak. But this is really, it's involved the governor's office. The governor's office has gotten involved to kind of try to help mediate and try to move things along because, for a while there, no new water was being approved to the village of Mount Pleasant.
That's the water. Let's talk about the land now. Now, you mentioned Microsoft already has a big chunk of land from Mount Pleasant that had formerly been dedicated to the Foxconn project, but you've been reporting Microsoft still buying up some more parcels of property. What's going on?
Yeah, so if you think about it, actually, there's the Foxconn site, and then just east of that is several hundred acres that Microsoft already owns, they purchased last year, and that's where they're starting their data center development. There's several hundred acres just north of Foxconn, and that is, again, they already purchased it last year. Microsoft purchased it last year, and that's kind of where another second phase is likely to go. Then, even farther north beyond that, is where in recent months and weeks, Microsoft has been buying even more land. So they're up to about 1,600 acres. They've acquired several hundred acres just this year. And the land that they're acquiring now was originally slated to be part of the business park that Mount Pleasant put together for Foxconn. But Mount Pleasant never went as far as actually acquiring the land from individual landholders. So a lot of what Microsoft has recently been buying are relatively smaller parcels that are owned by family farms or individual families. And they're, buying them, a few acres here and there and assembling a large, hundreds of acres again, even farther north in Mount Pleasant. So Microsoft has said this will continue to support the data center development that's already underway. And that's why, when we talked about under promise, over deliver, these are some of the indications that showing Microsoft is going to do more than they've said. They're just not necessarily wanting to promise anything right now.
What are you hearing from local and Racine County officials, for that matter, about their hopes for this Microsoft project?
There's a ton of excitement, within the economic development community that, not just the jobs, not just the AI expertise that we touched on, both of those, but just kind of the broader economic impact, the signal this sends to other companies of, hey, Racine County can pull off hosting a huge major company like Microsoft. What opportunities are there for other companies like that to potentially find homes in Southeast Wisconsin? So I think there's a lot of excitement around the momentum that this will bring for the area.
And briefly, what are you watching for next?
We will be continuing to watch for more land purchases from Microsoft. If you look at their land holdings in that north area that I've talked about, it's still a patchwork, so it's very clear that they have more land left to buy. We will be watching for when these data centers actually come online. I believe the first one is expected for 2026. And we'll see, how they continue to build out the data center complex. They've really only built so far on a portion of the land that they own. And so it'll just be fascinating to kind of watch how this rolls out. And then, of course, with the water issue, kind of watching to see where those negotiations end up, how Racine may renegotiate to kind of benefit more from this development that's really impacting the village of Mount Pleasant.
Teddy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Teddy Nykal is a real estate and construction reporter for the Milwaukee Business Journal. She was with us today to share the latest updates from the Microsoft data center development in Mount Pleasant. Hey, are you watching this all happen out your back window? Is this in your neighborhood if you live in Mount Pleasant or surrounding Racine County? Love to hear your thoughts, your hopes, your concerns. Email WisconsinToday@WPR.org. That's WisconsinToday@WPR.org.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, as Wisconsin ballots are soon to be set for November's presidential election, what are the effects of third-party candidates on the race?
Although they can't win, they do have the potential to have an impact on which of the major party candidates do.
We check in with a UW-Whitewater political scientist. That's ahead on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a Korean poetry competition in Wisconsin.
Shijo is a form of poetry that originated in Korea about 700 years ago. And today, it's gaining popularity right here in Wisconsin, as educators have established an annual Wisconsin Shijo competition. Sammy Kim recently talked with some of the organizers about their love of the art form.
Clouds stand still. They look painted on the canvas of the blue sky. Soft grass tickles my arms and legs. Birds chirp loud. Not loud enough to drown out the screams and yelling of my parents inside the house. Shijo is a three-line poetic form out of Korea. I am Elizabeth Jorgensen. I've taught at Arrowhead Union High School for the past 18 years. There's a theme. Line one is the introduction. Line two is the development. And then line three always has a twist and then a conclusion.
So it was a popular form of poetry among the literary elite, often used to express the struggles of everyday life. I'm Lucy Park, one of the founders and the executive director of the Sejong Cultural Society. There is a basic fixed format. It is very rhythmical. And even now, we made some Sejo songs into a hip-hop. They say go return to land that I don't know.
Everything my students do in my classroom, we send to writer's markets. And that's where I came upon the Shejiang Cultural Society. They host a Shijo competition. Dr. Lucy Park reached out to me and she said, whatever you're doing in your classroom is working.
In 2008, Harvard University contacted the Shejiang Cultural Society and suggested starting a Shijo competition for pre-college students. This was the first time we learned that Shijo poetry could be written in English, and it was a truly enlightening experience for us.
My students were doing really well. They were placing in the Shejiang Cultural Society's competition. You have no idea where it's going to lead you, but if you put in effort, those rewards are going to be bigger than anything you could ever have imagined for yourself.
So I wrote a Shijo poem about the moon. And then I thought about my mother and father. My mother passed away, and my dad passed away. Moon. I saw the pale crescent moon when I learned of mom's passing. Half moon smudged by the night cloud gazed at me when dad departed. Dear moon, with your caressing smile, who are you comforting tonight? 어머니 떠나신 날 쳐다본 창백한 초승달. 아버지 가신 날에 본 얼룩진 반달. 오늘 밤 온화한 미소로 저 달은 누굴 위로하나?
How can we get people to know and appreciate East Asian culture? And I had said, you know, what about Shijo? Could it be our window?
So for children, we want to educate them to become a global citizen. We can bridge the gaps that divide us.
Sami Kim brought us that story on Shijo, a traditional Korean poetry form. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Wisconsin Today.
Tomorrow is the deadline for county clerks in Wisconsin to deliver ballots to local election officials for the November general election. Some third-party candidates have fought to get their names on or off the ballot in time.
Last month, the Wisconsin Supreme Court decided not to hear a challenge from Democrats seeking to get Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein off the ballot.
And yesterday, a Dane County judge denied Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s request to be taken off the ballot after he dropped out of the race and endorsed Donald Trump.
Eric Lepp is an associate professor in the Department of Politics, Government, and Law at UW-Whitewater. We talked with him Friday about how third-party candidates have impacted past elections in Wisconsin and their influence in the lead-up to November. Eric, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Good day to you all. Thanks for having me.
So Robert F. Kennedy Jr. was running for president as an independent until he suspended his campaign in late August, endorsed Republican nominee Donald Trump. Can you help us with the basics here of Kennedy's campaign in Wisconsin? What are the arguments for and against Kennedy remaining on the ballot?
So the tricky issue here is that Wisconsin has a deadline in early August of filing paperwork to run as an independent, and Robert Kennedy did that. The laws in Wisconsin also say that once you have done that and you're successfully qualified, you can't really back out of it unless you happen to die. So when Robert Kennedy later in August, after that deadline passed, decided to endorse Donald Trump, he now has this puzzle of being on the ballot and kind of being stuck there. And right now he's currently working on kind of the last legal opportunity to potentially get off that ballot before ballots began getting printed.
There was sentiment from Kennedy's supporters that his First Amendment rights might be violated by not being able to get his name off ballots here. What do you see in terms of the argument?
So it's kind of tricky, right? Because the First Amendment says we can associate with who we want. And so logically, you could see the argument that people may want to stop associating with a group if they want to. The tricky part, though, again, is that through that nomination process, Robert Kennedy chose to be affiliated with an independent party bid. And no one stopped it or no one prevented him from doing that before. It was all on, you know, his decision, as was the decision to endorse Donald Trump later. So given that the law says that once you have qualified to be on the ballot, you can't be taken off of it just because you change your mind, that's going to make it a little bit tricky to argue the First Amendment case simply because the original decision to run was Robert Kennedy's through and through.
Meanwhile, Jill Stein running for president as head of the Green Party, as she has in previous elections. Stein will stay on the ballot as Kennedy is trying to get removed from the Wisconsin ballot. How do you see the interplay here, these two candidates affecting election results?
So in a state like Wisconsin, of course, every vote matters. And when I talk to my students about this, I always say that in the last few statewide elections, or at least most of them, the difference between the winner and the loser was about one end zone of Lambeau Field, right? Mm-hmm. So it's always very close. Anytime there are candidates running for office who are not one of the two major parties, they have the potential to pull some voters in who would otherwise vote for those major parties. So in the case of Stein, as well as Kennedy, as well as others who are on the ballot, their presence, even though they're not going to win, and even though they're not going to garner large vote tallies, their presence is still going to pull potentially thousands of voters away from either Vice President Harris or former President Trump. So although they can't win, they do have the potential to have an impact on which of the major party candidates do.
And the potential impact, Marquette University Law School poll just took the pulse on this in their most recent poll of Wisconsin voters, finding third-party candidates got 9% of the vote. RFK got 6% even after he had announced he was pulling out of the race. What can that tell us about what we might see in November?
Well, it certainly tells us that the potential for a minor party candidate to – we often use the word spoil an election, and I don't mean that in a negative way as much as I mean to impact the outcome, right? Whether you consider it spoiled or not is up mm-hmm. to the individual, I suppose. But if polls are showing even single digits, remember, the difference in Wisconsin is often 1% or 2% and sometimes even less. So I imagine that if additional polls are taken as we get closer to November, that third-party vote share will probably go down a bit as more people learn about Kennedy dropping out and endorsing Trump. Or more people start paying attention and feeling kind of the grind of the two major party candidates. But even in really, really close elections in Wisconsin, we see those third parties win enough votes to potentially tip the scales.
You mentioned the vote spoiler label, and I'm wondering if that label is problematic to seeing third parties in a different light.
Yeah, you know, I kind of pull back a little bit at the term spoil just because everyone should vote the way they wish. And I don't want to suggest that a spoiler is necessarily a bad person or someone trying to undermine democracy. What we mean, though, when we say spoil is basically the idea that their presence can tip the election outcome to one major party or the other, even though it can't really tip it towards the third parties themselves. So depending on your political views and which major party you're a part of, you would be thrilled to see certain third party or minor party candidates on the ballot because you would hope that they might pull a few votes away from the other major party and that those voters would kind of split a little bit. Again, not 50-50, but they would split some of the voters on the left or some of the voters on the right in a way that would help the other major political party.
Can you go back in history for us in previous elections? Why do we see somewhat successful third-party candidates during some elections but not others? You know, 2016, it seemed like third-party candidates got a bit of a boost in the election results. 2020, not so much.
A lot of it has to do with what the state of the feelings about the major party candidates tend to be. Mm-hmm. You might remember in 2016, there were a lot of people in Wisconsin and across the country who are not especially thrilled with either major party candidate. When those kinds of elections come along, you tend to see a boost in the third party vote share. But of course, it's important to remember that the third parties still never really come close to winning. The most famous example, of course, is 1992 when Ross Perot won almost 20% of the vote nationally, but he didn't get any electoral college votes.
We're talking with Eric Lepp, associate professor in the Department of Politics, Government and Law at UW-Whitewater, looking at the impact of third-party candidates and specifically in Wisconsin elections. Eric, we mostly see discussions around third-party candidates coming up during presidential election season, but are third parties very politically active down ballot on the local and state level races?
It certainly can be the case. It's also important to remember that if you're a third party, what you consider to be a victory or to be a success in terms of your political mission may not necessarily be to win election or even to get on a ballot. When you're a third party, the major parties will often try to win you over, to win your endorsement, say, kind of like Robert Kennedy, actually. And so they may be willing to maybe adjust their views on the minimum wage or something related to the environment. So third parties are often working behind the scenes with major parties trying to push their policy agendas. The major parties are often willing to work with them because they don't want to have any competition. So you're right. The third parties, although we talk about them during election season and the potential spoiling effect that they may play on election day, they often are working throughout the year and between elections to try to negotiate their place and affect the policy agendas of the major parties around them.
And on the point about competition, there are concerns coming from Democrats that are accusing Republicans of boosting third-party candidates like Jill Stein that way to encroach a bit, to eat away at Democratic support in states where we're seeing the battleground, where the margins could be really close, like here in Wisconsin. Could this strategy be in play?
It could be, but of course it's important to remember that any minor party that chooses to run for office has to go through the process of getting on the ballot, you know, getting the signatures and paying the fees and such. So it's certainly the case that a major party could try to nudge or support a minor party that would potentially hurt their opponent. But that happens kind of across the spectrum.
Do you think third party candidates cause voter confusion?
You know, it's certainly possible. I mean, imagine a menu at a restaurant or picking an olive oil, you know, picking olive oil at a grocery store. The more options you have, the more there is to process, right? It's just a lot of cognitive task on the part of the voter. And you often have third parties with names that may not be terribly clear in terms of where they fall ideologically. For example, the Independent Party, right? Where does that mean politically moderate? Does it mean they don't like the two major parties? Similarly, you might have a party like the Constitution Party, which might sound kind of conservative, but then people might say, well, what's the difference between the Constitution Party and the Republican Party? So it's certainly possible for voters to struggle with trying to process a lot of different party options sometimes.
All right. So we do hear the frustrations about this two-party system, that there should be more viable choices for voters. We've talked about ranked choice voting in the past. Where do you stand on these arguments and these tensions around the system in America?
You know, it's always interesting to look at the data on how many people are satisfied or not with our current two-party system. And the data recently are showing pretty consistently that there's a lot of people out there who would love to have more options. Ranked choice voting is certainly one way we could go. There are other rules too, like a proportional representation system, where you don't simply give out seats one by one to whoever wins a district, but you divvy up the seats based on the percentage of votes. So maybe a Libertarian Party comes along in Wisconsin and wins 10% of the vote statewide, they could get 10% of the seats in the legislature. So those kinds of systems are certainly out there. I'm, of course, a big fan of voters having choice, but I'm also a fan of voters being able to make sense of the political system. So you're right. There's a real delicate balance between kind of having enough choices and having too many to be able to process it all. As a practical matter, it's unlikely we'll see major changes like moving to proportional representation or moving to a national popular vote, because it's really, really hard to change current election rules. You know, people in power, people who would have to agree to make those changes are the people that got there under the current rules. So they're not necessarily keen on shaking things up. But as we have multiple elections in a row with a lot of people saying, I'd like to see more choices, it's certainly possible that there might be some major donors or former partisans who get together and say, maybe we could push out a message and try to create a new political group that advances our political conversation. Again, though, let's bear in mind that it's unlikely that we'll see a move away from two major parties and a handful of minor parties anytime soon.
Okay, so with your academic hat on and the researcher in you, what are you watching for in third party as we head into the November election?
Well, of course, one thing to look at is how many people who are currently undecided or currently supporting third party candidates decide to move to one of the major party candidates as we get closer to the election. When somebody calls you on the phone and asks who you're going to vote for, it's easy to say that you're undecided or to say, you know what, I don't like any of the major party candidates. I think I'm going to vote for Jill Stein. It's possible that some of those folks actually move over to support one of the major party candidates, because when you get in that voting booth, the reality is only one of the two candidates is going to win Wisconsin. It will either be Donald Trump or Kamala Harris. And if you vote for a third party, even if they most align with your political views, or even if you are really, really supportive of what they're trying to do, or they're your next door neighbor, the truth is voting for them means you're not actually participating in the competition that really matters, which is Harris versus Trump. So a lot of people will probably decide to vote for one of the major parties so they don't, quote unquote, waste their vote. That's another term like spoiling, which is perhaps a mixed one to use these days. So I'll be watching to see how many people start to move towards one of the major party candidates versus really stick with the third party and say, no, I want to make a point here. I'm not happy with either of my major party options.
Eric, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Be well.
That is political scientist Eric Lepp at UW-Whitewater.
Coming up, meet a Wisconsin researcher who's using sound to track down insects that eat crops.
In that big sound file, we can start to tease apart, are the insects feeding? Are they not feeding? If we separate out those crunches, we can start to say how many insects are out there.
That's coming up on WPR News. Hey, it's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Last month, the Wisconsin Dells lost one of its pioneering tourism leaders. Tom Diehl was the guiding force behind the famous Tommy Bartlett Show for more than 50 years.
We want to have the absolute best skiers in the world skiing here, and that's what makes the show so spectacular.
On WPR, we talked with Diehl in October of 2020, not long after he made the difficult decision to end the Dells' iconic water ski show.
Nothing beats being in a stadium with 2,000 or 3,000 or 4,000 people and having the excitement of what those professional skiers are doing.
Diehl said that losing crowds during the COVID pandemic ultimately led to the end of the long-running show.
Uncertainty is the biggest risk to any business, and the uncertainty going forward as to whether or not we would ever be able to play to 2,500 people a day next year made the decision almost an impossible one not to make to close the show down.
The Waterski Show was started by Tommy Bartlett in 1952. It became a permanent attraction on Lake Delton the following year, honoring the natural beauty of the area and through the decades helping to boost its tourism economy and become a major vacation destination.
It's going to be a big void for the Diehl family, of course, and I know it'll be a void for Wisconsin tourism because of its iconic nature.
Tom Diehl died August 29th after a prolonged illness. His family said in his obituary that a celebration of his life will be held at a later time. It's Wisconsin Today.
And that sound you're hearing is an aphid eating a soybean plant in southern Wisconsin. As the small pear-shaped insect eats the plant, it causes damage and could even kill it.
The USDA estimates between 20 to 40% of global crop production is lost to pests annually. But UW-Madison entomologist Emily Bick may have a solution.
She invented the insect eavesdropper, which uses microphones to detect and spy on pests as they eat and cause damage.
Emily runs the original digital entomology lab at UW-Madison and is an assistant professor of precision pest ecology and extension specialist for field and forage crops. Emily, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks for inviting me.
All right. What kind of things can we learn, big picture, by listening to insects as they munch away on our crops?
Part of the reason this type of sensor exists and other sensors like this are coming onto the market is because we have some really limited ways to learn about insects, right? Often, I work in agriculture. We often use a sweep net or a butterfly net with like an extra thick canvas bag and go out and count. But there are a heck of a lot more insects and there aren't that many people that can go out and identify them. So the thought with this is for especially the insects that are hard to find, ones that are eating, boring down the stalk of a corn plant, feeding on the root zone, those borers, the root feeding insects, where it takes a heck of a lot of labor. You have to dig up the plant, bring a butcher's knife. You can just directly hear if they're there or if they're not. You can then use some machine learning algorithms. Some very smart folks, smarter than me, developed these things to then tell piece apart what types of insects, what species are you listening to?
Now, we're talking to microphones now, and with my experience with microphones, I think this has got to be a challenge because you're trying to record what I imagine is a very, very quiet sound where, say, the wind blowing through corn stalks is going to be much louder. So what does it take to get a microphone onto, say, a corn stalk or whatever plant that's going to hear and make out the details of these insects?
Yeah, so these are kind of different than these air microphones that we have that I'm talking into right now. These are clip-on contact microphones or guitar mics or piezoelectric microphones. So it's basically a little brass disc that has an electrode attached to it. And when the disc vibrates, as in when the corn stalk is vibrating from the wind or a bite sound or a rain event, right? That is then translated through the electrode into an electrical signal. And then that raw signal can start to be teased apart. Does it sound like an actual bite? Does it sound like a person is sucking through a straw on this thing? Or is it just some wind and rain sounds?
Well, let's get a sense of what this sounds like. You supplied us with the sound. Now, this is a northern corn rootworm, I assume, munching away at the corn's roots.
I'll
go by the name here.
It is. It's a Diabrotica species.
Well, here's a listen. All right, so I'm hearing that background hum, that baseline hum, and then those clicking noises, I imagine, are our foes here. I was going to say our friends. Our foes, the northern corn rootworm.
They are, and there's actually two separate things that are happening over here. There's both a crunching, which is what we were getting in the middle of that sound bite, but also some tapping. So corn rootworms, in fact, anything in the Diabrotica species, uses its maxillary palps to literally bang on the corn plant. And they have chemoreceptors, so they can tell, you know, is there a lot of sugar in that corn plant? Are there kind of antifeedants or secondary metabolites, chemicals that the insect doesn't like? Is it the right time of day to be feeding? Even though they're under the ground, they actually feed at very specific times in the day. So in that big sound file, we can start to tease apart, are the insects feeding? Are they not feeding? If we separate out those crunches, we can start to say how many insects are out there.
And how big? I mean, we know that pests eat a lot of our crops around the world. The northern corn rootworm, for example, how big a problem is this?
So in the Midwest, in the Corn Belt, this has been called the billion-dollar pest.
Oh, wow.
So this is a serious economic issue. And one of the issues with this particular pest and this strategy is we don't really have a rescue treatment right now. So all we can do is say, okay, is it going to be a bad year? Is it going to be a good year? And then try to steer our corn plants for next year for this particular insect.
But something you mentioned is that part of what you're doing here isn't just, okay, are they there, but when are they active? Is that part of the hope that if we could say, okay, they they eat at midnight or they eat at dawn or whatever, that that can start to point the road to solutions?
Absolutely. So that time of day is really, really important. When you have a pesticide or a biological control agent, a good bug, let's say, that predates or parasitizes that bad bug, that pest, you have this major piece of interaction time where that pesticide or that good bug needs to be at the right place at the right time. And if you don't know when that right time is, you could be expressing, let's say, a BT cryogenic protein type thing. You could be expressing that protein that's insecticidal at the wrong time so that the insect just won't encounter it.
So I would think maybe one possible outcome is, okay, well, if I want to make sure I'm getting these pests, I'm going to spray three times in a day, or I'm going to do more applications. If we can pinpoint the right time, does that mean ultimately we hope to use maybe fewer pesticides?
That's exactly what we're going after, more sustainable growing of food. And when you say fewer pesticides, I should also note that organic orchards, organic agroecosystems, they tend to use pesticides too, but they also, those pesticides tend to not be as effective, which means that bettering that timing or bettering that spacing, or even that saying, is this pest here or not, is really, really critical in that go, no-go decision-making process.
We're talking to Emily Bick, entomology professor at the University of Wisconsin Madison, inventor of the insect eavesdropper. All right, you brought an eavesdropper with you. I don't know, if I saw this on a wall at a house, I might say it's kind of a big doorbell or something just from the outside casing. Describe it to us.
So we've 3D printed a case on the outside. You can look through the window on the case and see the screen and have some buttons, have some control over what's going on there. On the very back is a way to clip this case or this insect eavesdropper onto a stake or onto a tree or something. There's something grippy on the backside. But when you open the box, when you take the lid off, what you can see is a little Raspberry Pi or a computer on
a chip.
It's
a computer chip model, yeah.
Exactly. It's like two thumbtack boxes put together. That's about the right size. And that fully formed computer, although it's a little bit on the slow on the processing side, what it does is it says start, stop, and save. So it's starting the program. Attached to this Raspberry Pi is some storage. I can show you over here. We've got a storage place, a USB hub, and then four contact microphones, mm-hmm. as well as a way to power it through either solar or through a normal plug.
Yeah, we focused on that corn rootworm, but you're working with places not just in Wisconsin, I think, around the world. Can you tell us about some of the places that you're either currently working on or that are interested in the work you're doing on different kinds of crops?
Yeah, a postdoc in the Netherlands by the name of Sam Edwards, he's clipping on these microphones onto corn plants and looking at fall armyworm, which is a U.S. native invasive pest. It's native to the U.S. It's invasive across the world. And he's looking at some viruses. So he's infecting these armyworms with viruses. And he's able to differentiate, hey, look, is this virus taking? Is it not? What's the viral load? And I say he's testing this out right mm-hmm. now. But he's essentially looking and seeing how the behavior of this insect is changing in response to that literal biocontrol virus in this case.
And how about closer to home? Are you working with farms or farm operations in our neck of the woods?
Yeah, so we right now are really focused on researchers. So we're doing a fair amount at Arlington or Research Station, as well as West Madison Research Station at UW-Madison. So those are kind of our farming operations. But closer to home, we handed this out to Brian McCormick's group. He's the department head at KSU, Kansas State University. And he's taking a look at labeling a whole bunch of soybean pests. So soybean aphid, soybean gall midge, potentially, trying to see what's going on within the soybeans.
Is there a hope that within X number of years, everyday farmers, people who own farms would say, yeah, I'm going to pick up a couple insect eavesdroppers, see what I got going on?
The hope is either farmers or really it might be crop consultants, that this type of sensor, instead of having to destructively take apart your crop, ruin that particular part of the field, this type of sensor might be able to be clipped on instead of through the Raspberry Pi computer on a chip, just through Bluetooth through your phone, and then folks can tell what's going on in their field. Now, alternatively, it could be run as a network, right? So we monitor monitor all of these sentinel corn crops around the U.S. We have sentinel chicken cages that we monitor for flu-type viruses. But instead of having a person go out and check once a week or every other week, we might be able to do this autonomously with these types of sensors.
Now, looking at this insect eavesdropper here, it sounds pretty high-tech, but it sounds like you've been working to get components that aren't particularly expensive. That's part of the strategy here?
That is. We really know that accessibility is important. So at this point, this box costs about $120. We're hoping eventually this type of thing will cost about $15 a microphone, so about half that. Part of it is we're buying these off-the-shelf components, but price is a huge issue. So we're trying to make this as accessible to folks as we possibly can.
So what's the next big stage in your research that you're... You'd like to fast forward and find the results right now.
Yes. Density. Trying to quantify the numbers of insects on a plant is the top question that we have. And that's coming straight out of my lab. The reason we care about those numbers is we use the density of insects or the numbers of insects feeding on a plant at a given time as a way to make economic decisions. So we got this fantastic grant from the USDA, NEFA, Data Science for Food and Agricultural Systems. This is in collaboration with Brian McCormick's group at KSU to try to see if we could figure out how many insects are actively feeding on a plant at once so that we can get a better sense of those numbers that we need for decisions.
When it comes to insect threats to crops, are there new ones emerging, or do we have just kind of the usual suspects that are already always working with?
European corn borer is the insect that was once old. It's now new again. It bores down the stalk of a corn plant. It can feed directly on the kernels. And as soon as GMO BT was introduced, that particular insect was significantly less of a problem. So we in Wisconsin don't really have an issue with European corn borer these days. However, resistance has been reported in Canada. It's been reported in Connecticut. We were part of a study this past summer trying to see if it's in the state of Wisconsin as well. And that's the real question, right? So is that pest about to make a major, major resurgence due to these resistance genes. But at the same time, we have something called soybean gall midge, which hasn't yet been found in the state of Wisconsin, actually hasn't been found on Wisconsin's borders yet, but it has been devastating places like Illinois and Iowa's soybeans.
Does it feel like you're in this evolutionary arms race? Sometimes we come up with a way to beat this pest and give it a surprisingly short amount of time to evolve a resistance?
Not only are we in that evolutionary arms race, we're also trying to do more with less, right? The Environmental Protection Agency, that EPA, is not certifying pesticides or new GMO traits as fast as it used to. It's putting up a few more barriers, a few more restrictions, you know, for good or for bad. Some folks will find these really useful. Some folks will find this not useful at all, right? But basically, it's taking tools out of the toolbox for farmers. And because of that, we need to do more with better data. We need to do more with less.
And that brings us back around to the insect eavesdropper. Is that one of the primary goals, to help people in part by tracking that timing of when insects are eating, do more with less?
Yes, exactly. So if we know exactly when and where the insects show up, then we can precisely target those insects. We can do that true precision agriculture approach. Versus right now, we tend to spray on a calendar, spray on some limited scouting data, just because scouting is so cost-effective and labor-intensive and really trained labor-intensive as well.
Emily, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Emily Bick runs the Original Digital Entomology Lab at the UW-Madison and is the inventor of the insect eavesdropper. Bick's an assistant professor of precision pest ecology and extension specialist for field and forage crops. Head over to WPR.org. There are some pictures of the insect eavesdropper in action.
Starting Friday, bird enthusiasts will take a field trip to Superior for an event that's come to be known as Jaegerfest. It's named after the parasitic Jaeger and its cousins, who often take flight this time of year.
Later this week, we'll hear from an ornithologist who's been making the trip for 3 decades. The weather can be wild, anything from shorts weather to frost and cold rains off Lake Superior. Then there's the parasitic Jaeger, who eats by harassing gulls until they cough up the food that they caught. Think about that.
I have nothing for you. And we want to hear from you. What's the most interesting or unusual bird you've seen here in Wisconsin? And do you go out looking for birds even when the weather is less than ideal? Call and tell us about it at 888-642-0232. Or you can text that same number, 888-642-0232. Or email wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
And if you have some great bird photos, send them along.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.